So I'm back with Corinne Yu, and we just decided to take the interview and put it into two parts because we had such great questions from the Channel 9 audience. So we will send a link to part one and also Corinne's first interview on Channel 9 so that you can see what we talked about before. But now we're going to get right back into what Channel 9 audience wants to know from you. And this comes from Jambo GT. I'm currently at university where I'm studying C++ programming, game design, and game system architecture, as well as a few other related modules. What I want to ask you is what extra things should I take on board myself to learn that will help me in regard to the industry and would help me stand out from other prospective games programmers?
Okay, I think I'll answer the question itself, and then I'm also going to help out in a little bit other areas too. The question is like what other things to take, and that's a very good question because in addition to what he's doing, I think what will be really helpful is to really study a lot of mathematics. I think I either mentioned in this interview or a previous interview about the importance of the paradigm shift of we are changing now from being a 3D hardware rasterizer, 3D engine programmer into that of like a software rasterizer again. And then being a software rasterizer programmer is a totally different landscape. So you still need basically the hardware stuff, but you're going to need a lot more mathematics because in the future, I think by the time you graduate and so on, the innovation is going to come from not so much of how to make a fixed function pipeline faster, knowing how transform works and how to minimize the number of matrices and so on. It's going to be knowing math very well, using the math very well, and coming up with like new ways to represent geometry, new ways to represent lighting, new ways to represent material behaviors, new ways to represent simulation. And so I think it's kind of weird. I think the hardware industry had actually somehow managed to funnel education, because at one point education was really broad, and now all of a sudden we're seeing a lot of like very game specific curriculum, game specific universities, yeah, in which they teach they do have a great job, but they teach this really a relatively narrow focus of, if you know these set of things, you're going to do great, right, in
it's
the
like
job.
Like DeVry or something, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of weird because for the longest time, the hardware is, relatively limited. Shaders have a fixed number of things it can do. So as an education, it becomes a fixed pipeline education. So right. I think what he is experiencing right now would be that he's probably at the tail end of this fixed education. And this fixed education is not going to serve him probably in the next 5-7 years from now, because we're going to be switching from like, we're not necessarily going to transform things this way, we don't have to, we're not necessarily lighting things this way, we don't have to. And so what he would need more would be the raw skill to know how to develop things, versus just be like, oh, I can use the torque engine or something, and I know what is pre-transform and post-transform. Now those things are still important, like get the basics down first, but I would say in terms of classes, definitely take a lot more mathematics, like as many math classes as you can take and learn, and then also just on the side, outside of classes, just go learn even more math, play with more things, be more experimental. I think that also go into what I'm talking about with the paradigm shift too, was that the landscape of engine development is going to be a lot more experimental, a lot more free in a short number of years from now than before. So of course, like, know the engines, use these engines, make things with these engines, but do keep doing projects, keep doing side projects. Yeah. It's less important like how many you do them. It's almost not so important what is it that you make, but how much you learn from it when you do them. So I would say go do projects with the full intent of understanding why it works. Why is it that when I put a 3D model in this way, it become a rasterized model in that way? Understand the logic, the mathematics, the reasoning behind it. And then go ahead and be creative and try crazy. I mean, try things even if they don't work out. I mean, I think that's going to really set you apart if you go. I mean, I think a perfect example is like a guy that, I did go to a friend's house for, what was it called? The football, Super Bowl
Super
night
Bowl.
Or something.
Yeah.
Except all we did was just end up talking about, you know, the programming and also games we were playing anyway. But anyway, I was at the Super Bowl party with the guy that Microsoft had hired who did the hat tracking as a hobby project. And then he's been working in a town now for a while. And so that is an example.
Right.
Of like, well, when he does it, he doesn't worry about, oh, my friends are going to think I'm foolish, or employer is going to think I'm foolish. I should do something safe, like use a Torque engine or Unreal Engine to make a level and make a game. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like take risk with your project. Do something totally goofy. In fact, if you think if I videotape this on YouTube, my friends would make fun of me, that's probably the project you should be doing. Like, you know, like,
I love that advice.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you set yourself apart.
Yeah.
Is be creative. Do something, but do something not because this is like, oh, I should make a level in this engine
right.
and this get me a job. Because, you know, the 20, 30, probably 100 people are doing the same thing. Go do the thing where you feel comfortable trying something new that every people tried before, and that's going to set you apart. That, and also, even if it fails, say you try something like, oh, I want to make a, like a home style head tracking, it totally failed. But if you come to me in an interview and say, I did this, and I thought it was brilliant, but then when I actually did that, it didn't work at all. But then I learned how to do all this stuff. Like, as a potential employer, I'm going to hear like all the things that you did to get to a point where I failed, and it's still going to excite me more than someone who will be like, well, I used this engine that I downloaded, I made the level, and with this level I shoot things. Like that, I mean still good, that's a very good useful experience.
Yes.
But that's going to be less exciting than someone's like, I try a crazy thing, it didn't work, but I learned these really crazy things. That's the kind of thing that's going to really,
I want to hang out with you on this year's Super Bowl or next year's Super Bowl, I guess.
Yeah.
But you mentioned in part one that you had gone to MIT to talk to programmers. What were you looking for? Were you interviewing or?
I was interviewing programmers for, Microsoft had decided that I interview programmers for different departments of Microsoft. So it's some of it for Microsoft Game Studios, but not all of them for Microsoft Game Studios. So yeah, I interviewed them. They're basically, interviewed some people applying for internship. I also interviewed some people applying for full-time positions.
I'm sure the stack is that high of internships and full-time positions for you. This next question comes from Keith O'Connor. It says, given the possibilities, the raw horsepower of the SPU has opened up for parallelizing graphics techniques that would be otherwise impractical in real time. What sort of processor architecture would you like to see prevailing in the next generation of Xbox and consoles in general?
Well, I think what I would really like to see would be multi-core architecture that have a lot more forethought in it than the cell. The cell is basically the SPU of PS3, and the thing is, it was really good to have multiple cores, but I think the memory model and the data model of the cell architecture was not very well thought through. And one thing I would really like to see would be, you know, people dealing with cache issues and dealing with the memory and data transport issues just with a lot more care than how the cell architecture end up, you know, being. I think what we're really seeing is that we're seeing just, you know, data decomposing itself. And what we're really seeing in SPU is really the benefit of the architectural idea of data decomposition. And I've been like evangelizing data decomposition with the programming community for quite a few years now. And it's data decomposition is something that is also going to make Xbox be a lot more awesome too. In fact, one of the feedback that we get is like whenever people just work on, you know, making the PS3 run faster and better, the Xbox with no effort just become faster by itself. And you know why? Because what you did was basically data decompose. Now with the Xbox, we made it easy for you so you can still ship your game without data decomposition. So you didn't go and do it. But with the SPU, it was like they data decompose. Oh, look, everything is better now. Hey, wait, even on the Xbox. So what I'm really asking you is like, please go data decompose on Xbox, please. Even though not, we force you to. And then, And so I don't really think it's so much that it was a superiority of the SPU architecture, but the superiority of the idea of local data and data decomposition as a design pattern. It is a good design pattern for 3D engines. People should do it more often.
There you go, Keith Yes. O'Connor. Great. So now the next question comes from Manip UNI, M-A-N-I-P UNI. It says, do you feel that engines will continue to be written on a per-company basis, or are we going to start to see big, extremely powerful engines run most of the games on the market? Also, do you feel technology distracts from fun, i.e. 2D-ish Mario on the Wii versus Just Cause 2?
Well, there are actually two or three questions
in
there, so maybe we'll re-ask the second part afterwards. So with one of the question is, will the trend be, you know, a few big monolithic engines or each company writing their own technology? Now, in an ideal perfect world, I would really like to see each company developing the technology to the max based on the hardware and also based on the kind of level. I mean, it doesn't limit itself to lighting and shadow, but lighting and shadow is such a perfect case study mm-hmm. of what I mean by that. Any kind of game, any kind of scenario, any kind of level, there really isn't a good general purpose, the shadow, map shadow algorithm that would give you a highest quality shadow. And then you can basically say, well, I can, you know, have a 3D engine in which it has every kind of shadow possible. But no, that's not every kind of shadow possible. You can still, you know, have different sort of cascades. You can still, I mean, it's like just lighting and shadowing alone. It's not something that you're going to get the best performance, the best fidelity, the best, you know, graphical ability. And that's just one out of, it's such a small part of everything else. So just by just one case study I give, it's like your game running on Xbox 360, which just looks so much better, will run just so much faster. If you just have a lot of custom code that's specifically for the kind of levels and the kind of gameplay style and the kind of game that you're making. At the same time, I think I've got to be a realist here, and the realist is that it's a lot of engineering manpower, a lot of thought, a lot of effort to really build, you know, lots and lots of these things from scratch. Right. I can't argue the fact that shipping and making a game is becoming more and more complex and taking more and more people with a bigger and bigger team. I would say in the perfect world I just mentioned probably means that games will take a really long time to ship and will take a lot of people to ship.
But now why is that if technology is just getting better? And is it just because we want more? I would just think if things are becoming easier to create, technology is better, it's faster, more memory. Why is it taking more people to build it?
Because the technology is giving us more freedom. I think, at the so-called height of, you know, fixed point 3D hardware, software, hardware rasterizer programming, it was like, and also at that point, you know, polygon count wasn't that high too, was that it was like in a very happy place where, I mean, the team size is still big, but it was just, you know, of course, so the freedom to do anything too different is limited, so therefore the number of people it takes to do too many different things are limited. The freedom has gotten a lot more now. I mean, the good parallel that is that our team size have pretty much been growing exponentially in the game industry, just based on the fact that polygon throughput had increased, you know, relatively exponentially. So it's like now we can make more polygons, so we hire more people to make more of these polygons just on the outside. And that's just like one example of many where the more freedom and the more power we give them, then the more people would need in order to maximize their power.
Well, so the follow-up question from Manup Uni, I'm sure I butchered that, was, do you feel technology distracts from fun?
Yeah, and I think that it's very much like the opposite, because technology is a tool that, first of all, I want to mention graphical technology is a tool for immersion. It's that good graphics add a lot in a way that is not obvious to you, because you just feel deeper and more into the world that you're in. I mean, as an example, it's kind of like you know, is like, it's almost like saying, is good acting distract from good writing in a script, right? Because it's like you can write like the most perfect script possible, but unfortunately or fortunately, acting is the thing you see putting out there that make this writing happen. The same with game design. I'm sorry, but for the game to show up on the screen, it's need to be rendered out and rasterized on the screen. The worse it looks, the more distracting it is, the more it takes away from your experience. The better it looks, the more it feels and looks like everything around you is solid, and you know that then the less you notice these things and the more you're immersed into this game. So it's, I think graphics is a real unsung hero to immersion and therefore like game enjoyment. Now in terms of the other aspect, which is like other kinds of programming, is that I think other kinds of programming is absolutely necessary for a more fun gameplay experience, because different kind of simulation technology, different kind of things that would allow a player to interact with the game in a deeper and deeper level before, all that's technology, right? Natal is technology, and that's a lot of tech behind it. And the point of Natal is like a deeper interaction, you know, with yourself, away from a controller, your body, your hand, your arm, interacting. This is deepening, you know, your impact and your experience into the world. I mean, the same thing with a lot of the simulation tech that we do, in which, like, we you know, better detection of jumping and vaulting to have you doing, you know, crazy things, have you, you know, be able to destroy cover, destructible cover. It's like, it is possible to demonstrate a good game design idea with a simple lighting engine or no lighting engine, but that's kind of like a straw man argument, you know. It's kind of like I can read a good movie script, and or basically I can watch a play of pretty bad actors, and I can still kind of be like, oh, you know, this is still a pretty good play or something. But the thing is, it's the whole package together is something that enhances the experience, not take away from it. There's a third part I want to say too, was that I really love graphics, I really love programming, I participate deeply in the programming of it, but you know, every time I'm on a team and every time I'm on a game, I care deeply about the gameplay and game design too, and I always volunteer my time to design new gameplay ideas, design new features, and then because I'm a programmer, I can also prototype it and put it up there. So it's like, so there's the engine and graphics, and I do my day job, and this is what I do for my team. But on top of that, like the other thing I do was just like, oh, it's not graphics, but I know this is going to make the game more fun. I'm going to just, you know, just rip in there and just put something in there and just kind of show it. So I have a deep passion for how much fun a game is, way beyond just my job of, like, you know, programming graphics or something.
Well, and I think, you know, it's always come down to gameplay. I think every game maker would say, if you don't have gameplay, you don't have anything. And I think you give kudos to a company like Nintendo, who's done really well with. I mean, I love Mario Kart.
Yeah, it's cool.
But you know, I don't want to play Halo on the GameCube or the Wii. You know. Okay, so Kevin Daly says, sorry, but I can't help myself from asking this one: Halo 3 for the PC. When and if ever, and if never, why? Or at least, do you think we're going to ever see it?
I would first say that right now is not the time for me to answer what he talks about, but I do want to address what the category of the thing he's talking about is that I personally like programming PC quite a bit, mostly because the fast iteration of the GPU and the hardware. It's a very, very good prototype platform. And I also care about PC gaming a lot, playing the games on PC as well as programming on it. So I would say that the actual answer, he's not going to get any answer. Yes, he's tempted to ask it. He would get no answer about it. I can only answer personally that I really, you know, like, you know, programming on the PC a lot, like playing games on PC a lot, but that doesn't reflect the answer to anything that he's asking.
There's been a lot of speculation about that, and I haven't heard anything official on it, and I pretty much knew you weren't going to give us that, but Kevin, we asked it anyway. Good luck. If you find the answer, let Karen and I know. BrightGuy992 says, has there been anything you've been researching, new graphical techniques, architecture, etc., that you're really interested in lately and hope to apply to future games? If you could take any feature from a language other than... That's two questions. So we'll just go to that first question first. Has there been anything you've been researching, new graphical techniques, architecture, etc., that you're really interested in lately and hope to apply to future games?
No, there's been just tons and tons of stuff that has been really fun for me. Broadly in the category of dynamic radiology, broadly in the category of facial animation, broadly in the category of simulation, pretty much every aspect of a game engine architecture and design, and also broadly in like multi-core and just the various different interesting data decoration API for multi-processing too. I think all of that is it's very interesting, and I spent a lot of time just playing with a lot of these various things. And then sometimes it could just be just as mundane as even like, you know, assembly in mathematics and so on. But I would say that there are definitely like tons and tons of things in graphics as well as simulation that I've been super excited in. It's going to be very, very neat and exciting time to program a lot of things in the near future and far future.
Okay, and then BrightGuy92's other question was, if you could take any feature from a language other than C++, C#, F#, Lua, VB, etc., and put it into C++, what would it be and why?
Well, I think C++ has come a long way with the shipping of the new VS10. And then from what I know and understand that more language improvement is going to be on C++. So I would say the first step of C++, it pretty much like wrap up all the new C10 features that doesn't get it from the last time, because there's still a lot of room to grow there and a lot, so that's going to be pretty exciting. The Lambda stuff is really cool, and I'm really expecting that it's going to go way further with the next shipping of the Visual Studio. And then after that, I've been playing a lot with F#. I think F# is a lot of fun. It's a very convenient language for expressing mathematical concepts, and everything reads very mathematically. So I think a lot of the basic design of F# would probably, you know, end up eventually in like a design of C++, and I think that's a good thing. The other thing too with C++ that I would like to see more of, and then Concert have lead a good effort on that, and OpenMP as well too, is basically, you know, better multi-core support, better decoration of like data scope, you know, better recognition of local data. It is basically more language features to give a compiler of a set of source code more knowledge of how to optimize the lifetime of data, how to optimize, you know, what is kept by how long, where, and right now as a language is still very insufficient for the compiler to know everything it needs to know whether or not something can be put off into a job with its own local data or not. So when C became successful and was successful was because at one point a long time ago, C was something almost designed intentionally to map what a hardware does. It was like at one point what a hardware does is state machine. And then at that point there were a lot of like high level language, really clean and beautiful, and it didn't get adopted as well as C, because what the actual chipset, actual thing that were being shipped at that point were state machines. You know, it was what it could do were a state machine, and C was the state machine. So C became dominant because it mapped directly hardware. It gives the compiler all the options it needs to optimize for state machine piece of hardware. Now we've actually moved very, very far away from state machine. Now we're in basically, you know, heterogeneous asynchronous core, local data. That is what the physical hardware does right now. And at this point, never mind C++. People are saying, oh, C++ is broken. All the other languages out there are broken too. Your high-level languages really have so little concept of memory, and memory plays such a big part, you know, on optimization and compilation into, you know, things that are data local into things that are heterogeneous asynchronous cores. So So what we really need is for C++ to reinvent and re-evolve itself. Okay, state machine language, state machine hardware. Now, you know, this asynchronous heterogeneous multi-core hardware, evolve yourself into that. And then the way to evolve yourself is to be very local data aware, is to have like proper aspect decoration of, you know, what things belongs to what aspects and how these aspects interact. I mean, the inheritance model is pretty much basically broken when it comes down to, you know, mapping directly to hardware. The inheritance model is basically saying it is possible in these myriads of conditions for these myriad things to happen. Hi, compiler, have fun trying to make this fast, you know, on things, you know, on these cores. And that's kind of really broken, and we need a huge language cleaning up to go and make C live up to its legacy of being the language that maps to hardware. So let's make C. To me, C means language and maps to hardware. It's not. Yeah. It doesn't mean something like C equals to, you know, FOI func parentheses. You know, it doesn't mean that to me. So let's make the language that maps to that, and a language that maps to that. We're beginning to see the evolution of a lot of decoration, and I think I want to see that full force moving forward is to map to that now. So I would say the best way to design language is to go from bottom up, just to go from like, this is what the hardware does. Now make the language in which the compiler is able to generate very sensible, very fast code for this kind of hardware now.
I'm going to do that for you, Corinne. I'm going to create that new language that you need to put all those together. Charles says, what shared libraries do you use to help write reliable concurrent algorithms that target CPU?
Well, there is Concert and there's OpenMP. I think right now we're in an emergency state with language for multi-core. All of a sudden we've got hardware and honestly we have no language for it. Like, despite what people say about this language, no. That's still the wrong language. And so we've got some pretty decent measures. We've got like OpenMP and we've got Concert, the CONCRT, you know, concurrent RT. And what that does is basically allow us to pass hints to the compiler to let them know what scope, you know, various data variables are. So I would say that's a very good start. So definitely be very active in these advisory for these particular the language decorations, actively use these language decorations. And it's kind of funny, too. I think the we are in a very good place right now because I always think that APIs, 3D APIs, languages should really come from a bottom up. It should really come from usage cases, real case studies, not something imaginary from an ivory tower. So I think the first thing is to start data decomposing, start really programming everything to like local data only, and start even if your language doesn't support it yet, go ahead and start decorating your code with like the appropriate decorators for it, and become very active, you know, with the committees to start, you know, developing these languages and start using some of these things. So definitely Concert, OpenMP.
There you go. Yeah. Good question, Charles. This comes from Ian Todirel, T-O-D-I-R-E-L. Suppose you're on a team who develops a game for two different platforms, say the 360 and the PS3. You mentioned that you prefer to own the code bases. What would you do in this case? Have two separate code bases with some common ground, or would you use an engine that has ports on the both platforms?
Well, I think that what this is that there are like two levels of contract here. As a programmer, I really think that each SKU or each console really should be its own game. So I would say as much custom code as possible for each platform. That's what I would do, because the hardware performance behaviors and optimization characteristics is so different from both of them that each of them needs a lot of tender loving care. I would definitely do all the optimization and all the all the graphical features specifically for each of the platforms and what its strengths and what its weaknesses are. At the same time, on like the user level, then in this case, they will be the clients of the people using the tools, is that there should be a lot of commonality between the artist and designer using the tools to make the game to be like, I'm making a game of PS3, it's like I'm making a game, you know, on Xbox. So for the ease of using, convenience, and good art pipeline, you know, on the designer and the artist side, you know, it should be a very easy process for them to, you know, make things on a different platforms. But I would definitely advocate a lot of custom graphical code and a lot of custom performance code on both each of those platforms, very much so.
You seem to be definitely into the customization. I guess that's what makes every game so different. Also, he also says, what do you think about XNA? Does it have a place outside of arcade games? Could there be a place for Bartok in the video game industry?
Well, I think XNA is pretty exciting for people to kind of get into. You know, it's something that revs them up very quickly. The feeling I have with XNA and also with Unreal Engine and Torque is that I think these are really good things for people to get started on. At the same time, like the Xbox department, you know, have a whole set of tools also that are also geared towards, you know, developing for things to run a lot faster and a lot better. And the thing is, more than just Xbox 2, basically it's pretty much a Direct3D API. Yeah. So, I mean, a Direct3D API with like DX11, DX10, and DX9 has been very much written, you know, with the mind of like, okay, you can program on the Xbox and program on the PC. I mean, as an example, if you really get into DirectX 9 on the PC, you would have a pretty good handle on programming on Xbox already. So I think DirectX 9 serves a certain purpose. DirectX 11 serves a certain purpose. XNA serves a third purpose. And those three purposes are quite different. Because Microsoft is so good to have provided like this three kind of way to make things for a Windows platform and an Xbox platform, you know, people should pick the right API and right tool to do the right kind of things that it does. XNA is a very good thing to get something up and running very quickly. You know, DirectX, you know, 11 is a really great way to churn out all the possible power you can get out of, you know, GPUs on the PC. DirectX 9 is a really great way for you to program very, very much, you know, down to the core. Even if you have like no access to an Xbox or something, you can basically get a general idea of like what it's like to program down to the core, you know, for an Xbox. So it's I would say use each of these provided APIs appropriately. Okay.
So what was the Bartok? Where did I go? Hold on, that was Ian. Did I butcher that when I
no,
said...
No, it's okay, yeah. But, I mean, I would say that a lot
what
of
is,
these...
What is Bartok? What
it,
is
it
that?
Is a I think a lot of these higher-level things, yeah. I think, has this place for people to not feel intimidated, but I don't think we can get away from the idea that when you want to make something graphically supreme, that you really need to get to the low level of...
That helps me for sure. And then Ian Totoro's last question is, do you still write code?
Yeah, I've been writing lots and lots of code, yeah. It's really enjoying it, too.
Good. And the answer is yes. Yeah. Two more questions. We've got Magical Click. I want to know anything from mesh texture generation concept and tools that can produce a really nice-looking mesh texture during gameplay without much of processing.
Well, I think one of those questions come about as a discussion with demos, and I actually want to answer the question specifically with demos. I love programming, so I actually really enjoy programming loaders and demos. I've been programming loaders and demos for a very long time, and there is like a huge difference between when I do demo and loader work versus when I write a 3D engine. And both of them are equally enjoyable, equally exciting, but I do totally different kind of things. Now, as an example, when I make a loader, I make a demo, like I would just pull every dumb little trick in the book that I know absolutely cannot be gotten away with like a 3D engine on a game. I mean, one thing you can do with a demo is that every single thing is like axial aligned, and then you just global access everything meaning you just cheat, is that I know that in this world, everything fits in this box that always lined up perfectly. And I just know that at this XYZ position, I specified this thing would always happen there. And then I would totally take advantage of that in a demo to make things super, super tiny. I'll totally take advantage of it. It's like, ooh, who needs a traversal of visibility? The visibility is completely predetermined for this, you know, tiny little 2-minute thing or 10-minute thing it needs to run with this little thing. I can totally cheat and throw that away. So, and then being axial aligned, oh, I can save all that computation as well, saving all the matrices of the matrix, you know, the multiple transforms to get there. Oh, it's like directly there. So everything is just lined up perfectly for what you're looking at, and then nothing else. So I can throw that away. I mean, the other thing too is that the number of light sources will be 1, or the number of light sources will be X, and that's just like fixed. So it's kind of like in a 3D engine, will be sometimes there'll be, you know, 10 number of lights, sometimes it'll be 20, sometimes it'll be 3, and these lights would, you know, have 20 different properties. No, the light properties of something I make in a demo is like fixed, you know. Okay, this is what the light would do, and it would cheat in the most like cheater manner possible. It's like, if I can throw away, you know, even the Z value of something about a light, oh, I can get away with that. I'll throw that away. I mean, hence the axial aligned thing. So if everything is axial aligned, I can very often do a 2D computation that really ought to be in 3D because, oh, well, you know, axial aligned. And again, procedural generated data. The procedurally generated data is actually one of the supreme form of cheating, in which it's like, oh, I don't need to work with a group of artists that wants, and a group of designer who are not programmers, who want their model on the game to look this way, to play this way. I don't need to work. I am the artist and designer. Well, I can cheat by having, instead of like loading up data that an artist plays that way, that a designer plays that way with AI and so on, that it'll be like, I'll cheat. I'll be like, look, I can generate this. It looks great. It looks fine. I don't have to negotiate with a group of artists who's like, well, I know that the algorithm says it's supposed to go here, but I want it to go there. I don't have to negotiate with a bunch of designers who was like, when the fire splatter, I actually wanted to splatter in this other direction. It's like, so it's kind of like, even though the algorithm says the fire goes this way, now I actually want the fire to go that way. Give me a way to direct where the fire goes, right? Give me, okay, well, the smoke algorithm with this wind says it's supposed to smoke that way, but I, as a designer, I disagree, because it's very important for my game design for the smoke to flow that way no matter what your algorithm says going to flow. So it's like the kind of work that we do with a demo and with a loader is so totally different from what we do with a 3D engine. So and I get my creativity juices exercised in a totally different way when I make a demo than when I do making a 3D engine that works with a whole bunch of artists, a whole bunch of designers who want to wrestle a huge amount of control away from our team of programmers from us, where they would want things to behave illogically, not mathematically, and exactly where they happen to play something. And if, as a successful game developer, making successful games for a collaboration with interdisciplinary team, that is the kind of engine you need to make. The kind of engine in which it's always able to be override what the math says to what the designers and the artist wants it to be.
It's so fun talking to you because it's so obvious how much you love what you do.
I do, yeah.
It's so great. And this final question, I'm sorry, we have two more. Do you have time for two more questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so Ecaradec, is it me? Ecaradec. You talked about frequency space in a precedent interview. What kind of issues is best solved in frequency space? How much of an engine is rewritten between games? And do you have some advice on software design? We're just going to, which one of those would you like to answer for?
We'll go one by one by
one.
He has three questions.
Well, look at that. You're going to get all three of them answered. All right, so let's go first. You talked about frequency space in a precedent interview. What kind of issue is best solved in frequency space?
There are several kinds. The frequency space is really good when you basically have a lot of data that you have to gather from the environment in many different places. If something that that will be really slow if you have to go physically walk through all the space and gather it. It will be faster if you know all your data, the general property of the data is gathered all at once. So something that would have, you know, basically be very lighting for basically any sort of radiosity banks kind of thing would be much better, you know, solved in a frequency space than necessarily in a world space, because it's you're gathering kind of like the general ambience of various areas. So that would be an example of that. A lot of simulation would also be pretty good. I mean, simulation like fluids and so on, like basically things in which the behavior and observance of something in a local thing is affected by things kind of near and far. If something is only affected by something near, that's a very good thing to be computed in world space, because then you really scope what your computation is. If the color, the lighting, the behavior, the end result is something in which it is impacted by things that are kind of all over the place, then those kind of things are much better solved in the frequency space.
Okay, so the second question from Ekoretic is, how much of an engine is rewritten between games?
The different parts of it, this is kind of like, if you are making a new technique or something, I would say that lighting is something that is rewritten a lot, and I'm hoping to see lighting get rewritten, you know, quite a bit. And it's really funny, because at one point people think that like the lighting problem is completely solved. In fact, I don't want to mention this, but I think Carmack a while back was saying that, you know, oh, I think the lighting, you know, pipeline is probably going to stay in my engine the same way, you know, for quite a long time. And then right now, I think we're seeing a total shift of that, in which there's probably going to be a lot of change. I mean, geometry representation is probably going to also, you know, change in the near future. One thing that would get rewritten a lot, back to the good old staple Shadow again, I would say that Shadow needs to be rewritten every time you make the game again. Different kinds of levels and different kind of art assets is going to allow you a way in which you can make shadows and lighting just a little bit better by going ahead and spending the 10, 11 gear to just customize the look of it. The parts of an engine that should, like anything that is tools or something, it should really be, you know, backward compatible. You know, things like a bitmap loader, you will basically keep adding to it and just kind of leave it alone because, well, it load bitmaps, you know, it's going to. So an engine really consists of so many different modules. There's some modules that really ought to, you know, stay put. And then there's quite a bit of the technology side of it that probably should, you know, reinvent themselves based on the kind of games that you're making.
All right, and finally, do you have some advice on software design?
That's
a big question.
Very broad.
It is pretty broad, isn't it?
I would say that, I think I've mentored people in which it takes me years to go through the answers to that.
We have years.
He
got two of his questions answered.
Yeah, okay.
So we're happy with that. And this is the final question from Natty, or Nady, N-A-T-Y. Which limitation of the current console platforms are you most looking forward to being lifted in the next console generation?
Well, that's from Nadi Hoffman, a director of technology at Activision, okay. Also a friend I've known
okay.
for a while. I mentioned that I would mention his name at the company he worked at. So thank you very much, Nadi, for asking
the
question. So I would say the thing I'm most excited to see lifted would be the fixedness of the blocks of our shader path, because right now we still have basically this is a pixel shader, this is a vertex shader, this is a compute shader. I'm really looking forward when the arrangements of these blocks is something that we can manipulate ourselves, and then I'm really looking forward when we no longer need even blocks, in which you just program it like all the way through. I think micropolygon and is interesting. I mean, the hardware is not fast enough right now. Even with the API change, you know, MicroPolygon, the Reyes, it still doesn't, you know, run as fast as what a dedicated, you know, pipeline is going to be. So I'm also really looking forward to the limitation of how little I can advise or tell the compiler what kind of things to make faster and slower. It's just, it's getting back to the point where it's actually becoming optimal again for us to go and do a lot of assembly stuff, but it's not a very good code practice in terms of code cleanliness, readability to do a lot of that. And it's not so much that, oh, the compiler generated assembly code suck, it's that it is hitting a point where the compiler really doesn't know what to do with all the things. So I'm really looking forward to removing a limitation of how much and how little we can hinder compiler on how to generate, you know, better code. I think also the expansion of texture formats, I think it's going to be very exciting. I'm really excited about the sort of virtual texture addressing, in which texture is not necessarily addressed linearly and all in cache, in which it's like it would address things, you know, in portions, because that really opens up to a lot more different good shadowing and good like texture algorithms we can do. I think I'm really looking forward to the eventual dismantling of the barrier between just graphics and CPU programming. I think it's going to be very exciting to really have that all together. But it's not mature yet, and that's very important. It's not like, well, let's do it right away, right now. The hardware isn't mature, and the language isn't mature. I would say the development community isn't mature. The development community right now isn't data decomposing yet. So I would really like to see that happen, like to see these things being removed, but I would also like to see all the other different areas improve at the same time, so everything is ready for it at the same time too. So and with all that, it really comes down to I want to see the removal of everything preventing me from being a software rasterized 3D engine programmer again, because being a software 3D rasterizer programmer was got me into this industry. I was kind of just putting up with it when I'm doing all the fixed, you know, hardware rendering. But yeah, one thing I can't wait is when I can be, you know, a software engine programmer again, where like everything that I can invent it and program can, you know, just be there. That's going, that inventiveness, that creativity is going to be like a shot of, you know, fresh energy and fresh blood into, you know, being even more excited about what I'm already excited about, which is kind of scary if you think about it. So yeah,
Corinne, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Niner, great questions. Thank you for taking the time out. When I sent them to Corinne, she was like, these are fantastic questions. She'd love to come on and answer them.
Yeah.
And I hope if you get a chance to escape for a couple of days, you'll get to come to E3 so we can hang out a little bit.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
All right.
Thank you.
Corinne, thanks again.